Okay, so we look this evening at Parashat Tzaveh, which is in many regards an almost direct continuation from last week's Sedra of Truma. And as I said in Shul on Friday night in Shabbat, Parashat Truma represents yet another enormous shift in terms of the content of the Sidrot. If we look at, the Chumash as a whole, we've got various points of shift as we go through. So you've got Sefer Bereishit, which is about the Avot as a family. Sefer Shemot shifts to Am Yisrael as a people, as a nation. The narrative ends with Parashat Mishpatim, when it shifts from being narrative to being the Sefer Torah being a law book and having lots of mitzvot. Then Parashat Truma, we have a shift of number of Sidrot, really the second half of Sefer Shemot, dealing with the building of the Mishkan. And then that leads us into Sefer Vayikra, not so many weeks away, which deals with the operation of the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash. So last week was the Mishkan and its Kelim. And this week we have the Big Day Kahuna, primarily. There are other themes which come in. One of them is Bechot and the consecration of the Kohanim. But essentially, it's the Big Day Kahuna. Having said that, the introduction to the Sedra deals not with the Big Day Kahuna, but deals with the Shemen Lama'or, the oil that had to be produced for the menorah. Let's look at our opening pasuk. V'atat tzaveh b'nei Yisrael. So you should command b'nei Yisrael, v'yichu eilecha, they should take for you, shemen zayit zach, pure olive oil, katit lama'or, which is pressed for the lights, lahalot ner tamid, so that there will be a ner tamid, they will be a continual flame. We'll think in a moment just about this term ner tamid. Let's start off though by looking at Rashi. Rashi says, zach, what does it mean pure? Pure, it doesn't mean tahor. Tahor means it hasn't come into contact with anything ritually impure. Zach means that it's clear, as it were. It's no sediment, exactly. Belosh marim, without any sediment. Kamosh shaninu bimnachot, as the Mishnah in Masechet Menachot deals with megargaro brosh hazayit, talks about how the olives are selected, and you've got various different olives on the tree, which are used for different purposes. Cut it, if it's pressed, hazeitim, kotesh b'mach teshet, you press the olives with some sort of presser. V'eino tochano b'reichayim, as opposed to grinding it, that's with millstones. When you've got an olive, I don't really know much about olive oil extraction, but we know you go to the supermarket, there are all sorts of extra virgin olive oil and virgin olive oil and pure olive oil, etc., etc. So there are various ways of extracting the oil. So obviously, if you squeeze and crush, if you crush the or grind the olives, you'll get a certain amount of, or you'll turn it into a pulp, a liquid, whatever, and you'll be able to extract liquid from it, the oil from it, but that will have a lot of sediment with it. However, if you just sort of squeeze the olive just after it's been harvested and you squeeze it, so oil will come out of it, and that's what we're looking at. Not the olives which have been crushed or ground, but just the olives which have been squeezed. And then once you've extracted that first drop of oil, matan nitzan reichayim, then you can put the olives into the press, the tochanan, and you can grind them up. The shemen hasheni, now this second cycle of oil, if you like, pasulim norav kashelim nachot, it's invalid for the menorah. For the menorah, you have to use that oil which has just been squeezed out rather than ground out. But the second type of oil, which has been ground out, that can be used for the menachot, for the meal offerings. Shenema, and we learn that out from the pasuk. The pasuk says, katit lamaor, So it says that it should be squeezed, lama, or for the purpose of the lights. V'lokatit limnachot. It doesn't need to be squeezed if it's for the menachot. Good evening, welcome. That's nice to see you back in circulation. So what we're seeing is we've got this importance attached to the purity or the unadulterated nature of the Shemen Lama Or, of the oil which was used for the menorah. Al Derech HaDrash, we see some interesting observations I want to share with you, the two Moishas. It's appropriate to share with you two Moishas on this week's parasha. That's the Vilna Gaon and others point out, Parashat Tzaveh has no mention of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the only sedra from the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu till the end of the Torah where Moshe Rabbeinu is not mentioned. So the Vilna Gaon suggests that perhaps this was prophetic. Parashat Tzaveh is almost always, not always, but almost always, laying on the week of Zayin Adar. Zayin Adar, the Yahrzeit for Moshe Rabbeinu, is this Thursday. Almost always, this is when we lay in Parashat Tzaveh. So it's appropriate on the week that Moshe Rabbeinu disappeared from the world, that there should be a remez to that, a hint to that in the Torah, and this Shabbat will lay in the whole parasha, no mention of Moshe Rabbeinu as if he's in some way disappeared. But perhaps to compensate in a certain sense, I want to share with you a passage from Sefer Darash Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein's Divrei Torah, and then also from the Torah Moshe, which is the Chatan Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer. His Divrei Torah as well. So let's start with the Drash Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein. He quotes Rashi v'lo katit limnachot. If it's for the meal offerings, then it doesn't need to be cut it. It doesn't need to be that first drop of oil which was extracted by squeezing the olive, and it can be a less virgin type of oil. As we've said, if it's for the menachot, if it's for the meal offerings, it's kasher, even if there's sediment in it, the salku ashmarim v'nishazach, and you remove the sediment, and it's then it's a clear oil. However, for the menorah, tzarek sheme olam lo hayusham shmarim. That there must never have been sediment. So he's pointing out that you can't have this oil that's even for the menachot, it needs to be clear oil. You can't have sort of bits of olive stone, you know, floating around in it and getting in the way. But it can be filtered oil as opposed to oil which is naturally clear. So why do we have this distinction? Because for a person to be a moreha am, an instructor of the people, ulahani gam b'derech haTorah, a person who's going to lead them in the ways of the Torah, tzarech sheyu kol ma'asav tovim v'sharim l'chol roeh, then everything that he does has to be good and upright for everybody to see. Lo achar sheyazbir ma'asav. You can't have a situation where, if he issues a clarification, then it will become clear that he's all right, that what he did was all right. It needs to be clear, transparent from the very outset. Umitkila yachsvu sheino batov, because if it's something which there needs to be an explanation, then people's first assumption is that actually what he was doing was wrong. Some people will see what he does, but won't hear the clarification. They didn't hear or they weren't aware of his explanation. The Mishnah Masechet Avot, which tells the Chachamim, be careful what you say. You have to be careful in the way that you behave. This is the mashal here is that you've got oil which has got sediment in it. That means there's something deficient about the oil. And the leader of the people shouldn't have any chisaron. Even if it's to the degree that if you address the matter carefully and investigate, you'll find that actually he's done nothing wrong. Ela tzarklit nahig ba'ofen shelo ye'alav shum kushya v'chisaron, needs to live his life in such a way that there's nothing questionable about it whatsoever. Even though it would be possible to explain what he's done. What Rav Moshe Feinstein is drawing on, of course, is that the menorah represents the light of Torah education and Torah instruction. And therefore the oil, the fuel used in the menorah, has to be absolutely beyond question. It has to be absolutely pure and unadulterated. You can have oil which doesn't have sediment in it. That's after the sediment has been filtered out. And that would be no good for the menorah. The menorah, it's communicating to us a message that a leader of Torah, spokesman of Torah, it can't be that what he's doing is good once you've got rid of the sediment from it. There needs to be no sediment there in the first place. And, you know, unfortunately, this is something that we become ever more aware of, that, you know, in politics and Jewish politics as well, you know, every week you've got, you know, people, we see it in the media, that, you know, they've got to give an explanation as to a clarification as to what they said or what they did. That's, and sometimes people hear the clarification, sometimes people don't. Therefore, we want our Torah leadership to be absolutely transparent and beyond or above question. That's for other modes of leadership, then it would be all right to have the shmarim, the sediment which is then filtered out. But as far as Torah leadership and guidance is concerned, that's not the case. Sometimes you have it, you know, you'll have a rav, you know, will say something in a shir. And, you know, then it'd be questioned and have to issue a clarification and explain what he really meant and such things. That's, and yeah, once he gets through the explanation and the clarification, so it's all right, you know, yeah, what he was saying, it was reasonable and it wasn't offensive and it wasn't heretical or anything. But by the time you get through all that, everybody's, confused about things. That's, and people have lost confidence in the person who said these things. So that's a fine message for us, that when you're teaching Torah, you need to teach it in a clear way, in a way that doesn't need any further clarification. Sometimes, again, you have it, you know, a person give a drasha, you know, every week there needs to be a clarification what he said in the previous week's drasha. I didn't mean to be offensive with what I said. Actually, what I really meant was, you know, of course that's what he really meant, but it's not obvious at first glance. And Rav Moshe Feinstein says we learn this out from the mashal of the oil with the menorah. Let's see how the Chatam Sofer addresses this issue. The Chatam Sofer again quotes Rashi, Katit Lama'ov, Amru Chazal, V'lolim Nachot, Dilim Nachot Ein Ma'akev. That's for the Menachot, it doesn't matter. No, fine, it's got it had some sediment in, it's not a problem. For Amru, and Chazal said, Melech Basar Vadam, a human king, Notel Shemen Hamufcha La'achila, he does things the other way around. You think about, you know, if you've got a kitchen, right? You've got a kitchen, and you've got oil lamps hanging in your dining room. You know, go back 100 years and you had oil lamps hanging. So Melech Basar Vadam Notel Shen Hamuvcha La'achila, he'll choose the best oil to use for the cooking. Vagarua La'ir, and for the lights, so fine, it's got bits of sediment in it. So who cares? You're not eating the lights. You have to be very hungry, you know, to want to eat the candles. That's it's not candy, you drink the oil. Hakadosh Baruch Hu behipuch. Hakadosh Baruch Hu is the other way round. Katit la maor velolim nachot. Hakadosh Baruch Hu wants the light to be the purest fuel, and for the food, it can be a more inferior fuel. Obviously, not talking about HaKadosh Baruch actually eating anything. Because HaKadosh Baruch has a spiritual food. But the menorah spreads a divine light, an influence to Talmidei Chachamim. Umashchu shemen sasonu minachot v'shulchan yushpa sheva parnasar umuzonot. That's, and then the menachot and the shulchan, they spread shefa parnasa. They spread an abundance of material success. V'limedcha Torah, so what the Torah is teaching us is sheyesh shemen Torah tozach v'nakei. When it comes to studying Torah, that's where we want to focus on everything being the highest level. V'yakpid al shmu otav, you need to be careful about what you hear, and what you say. Because the Torah is what sustains us as a people and as individuals. Worry less about the requirements of this world, which are affected by the menachot. That, so what's the Chatam Sofer telling us? He's telling us that essentially very often we get our priorities the wrong way round. That a person will spend a small fortune on a silk tie. That's when it comes to buying his Arba Minim, that's he wants to get a cheap set. That's or not just in terms of what he spends, but do we have the highest aspirations for spirituality or the highest aspirations for the physical world? He's saying we learn from here, katit lama'ov lo katit limnachot, is that the highest quality needs to go towards our spiritual development. That's in terms of our physical development, that's, or, you know, then, you know, we need to have, you know, it needs to be good, but it doesn't necessarily need to be the top and most outstanding quality. And, of course, often people have their priorities the wrong way around. That's, you know, we like to excel in so many ways. Do we seek excellence in Kodesh in the same way that we do in other areas of life? We like to have, invest in things. Do we invest in Kedusha in the same way that we invest in Gashmiut? So that's something to ponder. Just this last phrase of this opening pasuk, la'alot ner tamid. What does the ner tamid, what do we mean by a ner tamid? How would we best translate ner tamid?
To ever present.
Ever present, continual. That's, traditionally, I think we talk about the everlasting light. That's, in my previous shul, I used to, part of my responsibility was we would have local school groups coming to visit the shul. That's, they don't really want to see this shul, but they'd come to visit the shul, and my job would be to show them the various appurtenances, etc., in the shul. So I'd always point out to them the everlasting light. You know, why is it called the everlasting light? So, yeah, we work out because it's always on. That's except for when. And they'd always, it's not on Saturday, it's not on. No, yeah, no. It's always on except when there's a power cut. There was a famous time also, that's when, I showed them in front of the shul, we've got the ark. Does anybody know what? They usually learnt a bit about Judaism before they came. So, does anybody remember what's kept in the ark? And one little girl put up her hand and said, the animals. That's so she'd got her stories a little bit confused. Now, a lot near Tamid.
That would make sure quite good fun, wouldn't it?
Would indeed. There's so much. There's so much that one could say. That Lahalot Ner Tamid, according to most professors, doesn't mean to say that the menorah didn't have to burn 24/7, but Lahalot Ner Tamid means that this was something which was done on a daily basis. On a daily basis, the menorah was lit. There's a view that the Ner Maravi, one of the lamps, burned continually. certainly the rest of the menorah didn't burn continually. That's, but it means, if you like, permanent. This is something regularly, it's done every single day that the menorah is lit. Let's move on now to what is the dominant theme in the parasha, and that is, of course, the big day kahuna, the priestly garments. Moshe Rabbeinu is instructed that he should make big day kodesh, holy garments, la'aron achicha, for Aaron, your brother, lechavod, ulatifaret, for honor and for splendor, which of course tells us nothing. That's what we mean by lechavod ulatifaret. These big day kahuna should be lechavod ulatifaret. Let's look at what the Sforno says. The Sforno says lechavod, lichvot hakel yitbarach. This is a form of honor to Hashem. B'yotam big day kodesh lavodato. The people wearing big day kodesh, holy garments, when they served him. You don't show up in the Beit HaMikdash to do the Avodah wearing jeans and a t-shirt. There's not nothing necessarily anything wrong with jeans and a t-shirt. But it's inappropriate for the Avodah. It doesn't suggest that this is a matter of the utmost respect and importance to you. So that's Lechavod. Lechavod is for the honor of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ula Tiferet, Tiferet, the splendor, Shiye Kohen More. That's that the Kohen should be feared. Nora al kol sevivav. That's everybody around him should be in awe of him. Shein talmidav hachokukim alibor tefav. That's everybody is the Talmud of the Kohen. That's, but the point is that the chavod or the tifaret, these aren't simply synonymous terms. They're referring to different foci. That's, in one case, the focus is on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in the other case, the focus is on the people. That's, so it's to show chavod to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you've got smart clothes, but also you want to make an impression on everybody around you. That's, you want to show up dressed for business, so that you look the part. That's the people will realize that this is you are an important person, not necessarily intrinsically, but because of the task that you are doing. Now, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, unsurprisingly, deals at length with the symbolism of the big day kahuna. I want to go through a passage from Rav Hirsch, which deals very much with the concept of the big day kahuna, not the specific symbolism of each of the begadim, but the overarching concept of the big day kahuna. Let's see what he says. Big day kodesh are holy garments, or really garments of the sanctuary. So there's no, not necessarily intrinsic kedusha about them, but these are garments which are worn when one goes into the sanctuary. Garments which show the wearers are standing in the service of the sanctuary. Lechavod. Now, till now, we've translated lechavod as being for honor. Kavod is the spiritual kaved. Kaved means heavy. The weight, the mass, that by which the spiritual and moral content, the character of a person, impresses itself on others. So that the meaning of kahuna is to express itself in the garments. At the same time, they are to be made in such a manner that they also serve as tiferet to the kohen. Pe'er, related to be'er, this is what I've called, hopefully not rudely, but Rav Hirsch's word games. Pe'er, it's related to be'er. Per and Ber sound similar. If you've got Be'er, then it can come be Bahar. Bahar comes Bechar, which all have the idea at root of shining forth, being conspicuous or distinguished. Letiferet adds the demand that besides the given necessary conditions expressed by Lechavod, The garments also satisfy the requirements of the sense of beauty. They distinguish the Kohen in an aesthetic manner. So saying this notion of lechavod, it's something about feeling a weight on your shoulders. It's like the Kohen wears these garments so that he should feel the weight of responsibility on him. That it's not just we think about kavod. Kavod is is honor, but he's saying so. It's piling something onto somebody. It's also something. It's something which is kavod, something which is heavy. So it's making an impression on the Kohen as the wearer that he's got a priestly responsibility, and it's also l'tiferet. That's to project something outwards as well, a sense of splendor, a sense of beauty. So we're saying that the clothes represent the kavod of the kahuna. That's not just the honor of being a Kohen, but the responsibilities, if you like, of being a Kohen. That clothes can express the priestly character lies both etymologically and actually in the Jewish conception of clothes. We have already had occasion to remark on the phonetic relation of beged to pakad. Pakad means to remember or to pay attention to something. Just as pakad denotes the mental or spiritual investment of something with its appropriate attributes, so beged too does not express merely a covering, but clothing which gives man his appropriate appearance. As pakad also means investing in office, so can beged have a very similar meaning. Actually, clothing has a very significant origin in the history of man's moral upbringing. And because of this origin, moral importance, it was given as an eternal reminder of his moral calling as man by the father of mankind when he dismissed his children from paradise out into the educational school of work and self-sacrifice with its attendant danger of animal erring. Clothing is itself a reminder of man's calling. And this is the first and most striking appearance which characterizes a being as human. So very, very interesting idea. You know, we don't necessarily talk a lot about clothing. He's telling us lots of things about the term beged. Okay, a beged isn't just an article of clothing, but if beged is related to the word pakad, which can mean to invest somebody, that's... So therefore, you'll have here also that when you wear certain clothing, it invests you with certain responsibilities. So at the beginning of history, we have, when did Adam and Chava first get their first clothes, set of clothes? When they were thrown out of Gan Eden. They only had one set of clothes, a birthday suit. Now they've got a different set of clothes. That's impressing upon them the responsibilities of being human as opposed to the difference of being an animal. No animals create clothes for themselves. Sometimes people buy coats for their dogs, right? But that's not a natural way of dogs getting dressed. No, nobody's ever seen a dog choose and put on its own clothing. Humans do that for a different reason, you know, do that. And clothing, as we know, that clothing has multiple purposes. It's part of the purpose of clothing, a large part of the purpose of clothing, is, of course, to protect ourselves. None of us go out in the cold winter's evening, like tonight, without a shirt on. Right? That's we want to protect ourselves, put a coat on, we want to keep warm. But clothing also communicates a message that's about either how we want to be perceived, or if somebody else is giving the clothing, about perhaps how we have to behave. So if we've chosen our own clothing, that's so Tal and I have decided to wear ties. That's we want to communicate a particular message about how we want you to perceive us. though Tal's tie is now hanging about 4 inches down his... so that's also communicating a message. That's Tal wants to communicate the message of the tired executive who only has time to loosen his tie, not even relax sufficiently to take it off. That's, of course, if Tal is told that he has to wear a tie, that so then the message is that, you know, you're expected to behave in such a way. So then the clothing becomes not just the way that Tal wants to project himself, but it's really the force that is piled onto or the direction, the way that Tal, the responsibility which is invested in Tal or in anybody else. That's so. The big day kahuna, or begadim as a whole, Rav Hirsch is telling us, it's a very interesting observation. I think he's telling us that it's giving us a mission. Clothes reflect what our mission is. We think that we are justified in assuming that the garments which are essential for the priest to appear as priests also have to express the character which the priest is to represent as such, that they are not to be simply external adornment. They must mean something which is not only to affect the mind of the onlooker, but to have a meaning for the wearer himself. It's shown by the law that absolutely nothing may intervene between them and the body of the priest. Okay, this is a din in the Big Day Kahuna. There mustn't be any chatzitza. There mustn't be any interruption. If the Kohen has got his arm in plaster or something like that, he's not able to do the avodah, he's not able to wear the Big Day Kahuna. If it's cold, the Kohen can't wear a woolly vest underneath his Big Day Kahuna. The Big Day Kahuna need to be mamish on him because they are supposed to be affecting him and impressing upon him a certain message and a certain idea that they must be in direct contact with and completely cover the particular part of the body they are meant to cover. The priest must be entirely at one with his garments. So these Big Day Kahuna, again, it's this dual purpose, l'chavod or l'tiferet. That's it's kavod for the Kohen, not in the sense that, it gives him honour, but it gives him a purpose, or reminds him of his purpose, his destiny, his role, and it's l'tiferet to project an image to others as well. That's the dual role of the Big Day Kahuna, and in general, that's the dual purpose of clothing. I don't know if he's avoiding the word uniform. But that's clearly what it is. It clearly is a uniform, and a uniform, of course, does both things. If you're a pilot or a steward on an airplane, right? So you wear the uniform. That's to impress the customers. That's the passengers. If you just show up in the jeans and the t-shirt, the first class passengers aren't going to be impressed. But it's also to give you a sense. If you have to be smart, you'll produce a smart product as well. Inasmuch as it is with these garments that the priest enters into the service of the sanctuary, and it is the nation that hands him the garments, the clothing of the priest expresses the character, the attainment of which the nation understands to be the task demanded by the sanctuary of God's Torah. It expresses the kedusha, which the mikdash is to bring to the Jewish personality, which it expects from the Jewish personality. Inasmuch as the Big Day Kahuna are divided into the high priest's garments and the regular priest's garments, but the high priest is the real representative of the mikdash, to whom the regular priest only stand as subordinate helpers. Further, that the high priest's garments also include the four of the regular priest, to which the four special ones which complete the high priestly garments are only added. We must regard the high priest's garments as representing the ideal Jewish qualities, the idea of Yisrael as the perfect Jew, to which the regular priest's garments represent the qualities which form the preparatory stages. This is also a very interesting notion in Rav Hirsch. Essentially what he's saying is that the kahuna isn't something separate from the people, but the kahuna is essentially a model for the people. That's and that fits in, I guess, with the notion of Atenti Yulimam Lechet Kohanim for Goy Kadosh, that everybody is part of a kingdom of Kohanim. We've got the Kohanim to set us an example. That's an example for everybody to aspire to. So the everybody should aspire to be, to live up to the ideals of the Kohen Gadol. And the preparatory stages of being a Kohen Gadol are being a Kohen Hedyot. If we contrast in our minds the picture of the regular priest in his white garments and the high priest in his golden garments, the regular priest appears in the preliminary stage of the Chatzer, which also bears the ground color of purity, whereas the high priest is clothed in the materials and colors of the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodashim. The Kodesh and Kodashim had all these hangings, which were multicolored, and that's represented by the big day kahuna of the Kohen Gadol. In any event, the point that the Rav Hirsch is making to us is, of course, the role of the big day kahuna, both in looking inwards and looking outwards. So it's a message to the Kohen, and it's a message from to the people about the Kohen. I think it's instructive to look at also what the Sefer Achilut says about the role of the Big Day Kohuna. And he's reinforcing a notion, an idea that we've encountered previously. Mishar Shea Mitzvah. What's the big mitzvah of the Big Day Kohuna all about? Hayasod HaKavu Alanu, the principle that is established for us is Ki Adam Nifal Lefi Pu'ulotav. This is a key theme in the Sefer Achinuch. A person is influenced by how he behaves. And a person's thoughts and beliefs and ideas follow the way that he behaves. So a person who is a shaliach of ours to achieve kapara in the Beit HaMikdash, i.e. the Kohen, who offers up the korbanot and achieves atonement, he has to be totally focused on the avodah that he's doing. Therefore, it makes sense that the Kohen should be wearing a special uniform, so that when he looks at any point on his body, he'll immediately have a reminder of what he's doing and who he's serving. So there came tefillin. That's similar to the tefillin. Everybody's told you have to wear tefillin on your body, so that it should remind us to have appropriate thoughts. It's true that the Kohen also wore tefillin. So he also wore the big day kahuna because the task that he was doing was so sacred. So the Sefer Chinuch has got this idea, as I say, that we're influenced by what we do. That's why we have so many mitzvot in various particular categories. It's to reinforce with us a particular idea. So the Kohen had to wear the big day kahuna so that he would always have a sense of the purpose that he was working towards. That's, again, if we go back to the jeans and the t-shirt, the Kohen comes to do the avodah in the jeans and the t-shirt, hardly notices that he's doing something special. If he wears a special uniform, then he's aware that he's doing something special. That We mean our Talmud's there. Now he's going to explain certain aspects of the particulars of the Big Day Kohuna. When we Talmud's there, Ne'mar shenit chayvu lihiyot orech haketonet al kol gufo ad lamala min ha'ikef ma'at. That's why, for example, the robe that the Kohen had to wear had to cover his whole body right down to the heel. Forech beit yad shela ad pas yado. The sleeves went down to the wrist. That's just above the palm of the hand. For mitznefet or kashish esrei amah, the mitznefet, we think about the mitznefet, the headgear that the Kohen wore. That's, we sometimes don't realize that its length was shesh esrei amah, 16 cubits. That's 24 feet long. That's a lot of windings, exactly. That's umaki faberosho, it would wrap it round his head. Kadeshi yireota b'cholet sheisai enough. It wasn't just he had to wear a kippah. Okay, he had to wear something that would, was wrapped around so many times that every time he looked up a bit, he could see it poking over. V'ha'avneit shechol geba motnav. And the avnet that he wore wrapped around his middle. Orkol lamed beitama. That was 32 amot long. Okay, that's 48 feet long. That's a very long, lot of wrappings around your middle. Umaki for machaziro agufor krach al krach. You wrap it round and round and round. That means, again, it's quite bulky there. We think about the, you know, the avnet, the belt that the Kohen wore. So, okay, it wasn't a leather belt, but it was, you know, we think of it as being a gartel. It's far more than a gartel. That's, it went round and round and round. It, you know, held your arms out, so you always felt it. They're always knocking into it. That's because it was so thick, because of all the windings. Your arms would keep bumping into it. This all supports, says the Sefer Chinuch, what he's already said. In addition to the fact this is, it does give kavod to the Beit HaMikdash and to the Avodah. If the person doing the Avodah is wearing a special uniform. You want the Beit HaMikdash to be a very inspiring place. Why do you want the Beit HaMikdash to be an inspiring place? So that when a person goes there to do to bring a korban, they'll do genuine teshuva. They'll say, wow, I'm here. I'm here in the Beit HaMikdash. I've got to do teshuva. I'm in the presence of Hashem. Again, if they feel it's like, you know, drop off of the council tip, right, then they're not going to feel anything special. They're not going to have a real sense of dedication to the cause. So that's the notion there in the Sefer HaChinuch, this notion of being influenced by what we do, and that's you know, particularly the Big Day Kohuna making an impact there on the Kohen. This notion of being influenced by what we do has lots of applications and manifestations in our own, you know, religious lives. You know, it's sometimes a question, you know, that you know, sometimes a person, I don't know, you know, will grow a long beard, right? That's, you know, it doesn't make him frum. That's, having a long beard doesn't make a person frum. But, you know, maybe it's going to inspire the person to try and become frum. That's, you know, why a person might grow along with. I'm well aware that this doesn't make me frum, but it's hopefully motivating me to do that. But, you know, with other things as well. And sometimes, you know, a person doesn't feel motivated to do a particular mitzvah, doesn't feel motivated to come to shul, that's you know, etc. Doesn't feel spiritual awakening. Nevertheless, that's if you do these things, then sometimes, you know, rather than just, oh, I feel inspired and therefore I go to shul, sometimes you need to go to shul and as a result, hopefully you'll feel inspired. I know sometimes people tell me I come to shul and I went home less than inspired. But the goal is that you should come to shul and at least cumulatively become inspired. I don't want to look at too many details of the particular Big Day Kohuna. I want to look at two aspects of them. I want to start off with the least noteworthy of all the Begadim, and that was the Michnasayim, the trousers or the pantaloons or whatever they were. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Emet Yaakov make some interesting observations here. If we look in Perek Kafket Pasuk Mem Aleph, if we look through the Big Day Kohuna, that the Kohen Gadol had 8 begadim, right? 7 of them are dealt with. There's no mention of the Michnasayim. The Michnasayim only get a mention after we're told that the Kohanim were dressed in the Big Day Kohuna. Then the Pasuk says, Vaselahem Michnasei Vad. Also, you should make Michnasei Vad. You should make linen trousers for the Kohanim. So it comes almost as an afterthought. Vzeu Miderech HaTzniut. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky saying, this is a matter of tzniut, of delicacy. That the Chein Lahalam B'Farshat Pekudei, that we find later on in Parashat Pekudei, Ve Banav Takrivu Bashtol Tam Kutanot, where it's talking about that Moshe Rabbeinu investing the Kohanim, and he says that he's told Aaron's sons will come, and Ve Bashtol Tam Kutanot, you put the robes on them. For Lois Kira Mikhlasim, no mention of the trousers. Gamba Parashat Sav, Aitin Alavet Kutanet, Viacha Kachvat Krevon Moshe Rabbeinu Aaron, Vayabashim Kutanot. There's mention of the kutonet. There's no mention of the michnasayim. Tsarichim bazeh. This needs attention. Im lav shuheim ha-michnasayim ba'atzmam. That's... Is it to say that the Kohanim put the michnasayim on themselves rather than being dressed in them by Moshe? Perhaps it's a function of tzniut that they're not really mentioned amongst the Big Day Kohuna. The point that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is making is really showing us a great sensitivity the Torah has to these sorts of things. We're not necessarily talking about tzniut here in the contemporary sense of, it's a woman dressed in a manner of tzniut. We're talking about here a sort of certain sensitivity to, it's not appropriate to talk about undergarments. These are things which are necessary. They don't need to be publicized. The Kohen had to wear them, but they didn't have they were there for a practical purpose, to conceal something rather than to give the Kohen a real sense of purpose. Want to finish off with an observation about the Urim V'Tumim. That's, we have the Choshen, the breastplate, and the breastplate had to be made in a particular way, and it had the various stones. And then in Pasuk Lamed, we're told, V'natatayel Choshen HaMishpat, you should put into the Choshen Mishpat, Et HaUrim V'Et HaTumim, the Urim and Tumim, V'yu'al Lev Aaron B'vo Lifnei Adonai, the Urim and Tumim, they should be on the heart of Aaron when he comes before Hashem, and as Aaron et mishpat b'nei Yisrael al yibol lifnei Adonai tamid, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel on his heart constantly before Hashem. Question is, what were these Urim v'Tumim? What were the Urim v'Tumim? So the Ramban quotes the Ibn Ezra, who says that it was a metal plate that was put inside the breastplate, that had the Shem Hashem on it. So the Ramban disagrees with the Ibn Ezra and sides with Rashi, who says that it wasn't a metal plate. If it was a metal plate, that would be described. Would be described how to make it, like all the other things would describe exactly how to make it. So rather, the Urim and Tumim were just written on a piece of cloth. It was Hashem's name written on a piece of parchment, placed inside the Choshen, so that then when the Kohen, or the king, spoke to the Choshen to find out what Hashem wanted, then the lights, the letters would be able to light out and communicate a message. That's the way Rashi understands it. Haktava Kabbalah, he says it doesn't mean that. He brings a proof, we won't go through this inside, but he brings a proof from the Rambam. Now, the Rambam doesn't actually, even though the Rambam goes through all the big day kahuna, he doesn't talk about the Urim V'tumim. No instruction in the Rambam how to make the Urim V'tumim. So Haktava HaKabbalah says the Urim V'tumim is actually the stones themselves. The stones are known as the Urim V'tumim, and that's the 12 stones on the breastplate. Why are these 12 stones known as the Urim V'tumim? It gives two explanations. It says, number one, it's because they are Me'irim, okay, they light up, Urim, so they light up, V'tumim, and they give a tam answer. They give a perfect answer. They tell you exactly, they say it as it is. So that's the Urim the Tumim. That's the first explanation. But he says, also in actual fact, the very Lashon Urim Tumim describes how these stones were made. Urim means they were shiny. These were shiny stones. And they looked like they glowed, they glistened, whatever they shone. That's the Tumim, means they were complete. That's meaning they weren't carved. Each of these stones, and there's a lot of discussion amongst the Mepharshim, that's as to what exactly these 12 stones were. But it wasn't that you've got an onyx that has been cut down to shape, whatever. That was the stone as it was mined, or as it was found. That was the size that it was. It was perfect, it's at the right size, and it fitted in. So Urim, shiny. V'tumim, and perfectly formed stones. And didn't have to be chopped or cut up or anything like that. And that's why they're called the Urim V'tumim. Let's leave it there for this evening. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll look at Parashat Ki Tisa. We'll also perhaps look at a few themes.